Hello and welcome to another episode of the Something Rotten podcast. This is, I think, what everything has been leading up to. My name is Jacob Geller. I'm joined, as always, by Blake Hester, and we have finished the video game Metal Gear Solid 2.
Jacob.
Blake?
It brings me no joy in reporting that on the day after finishing Metal Gear Solid 2, a momentous occasion marking the end of another Something Rotten season. My little puppy's sick. She don't feel so good. It's so unfortunate. Reagan's sick. Isn't that sad? Isn't that very sad?
That is very sad.
Yeah, she gotta go to the vet. It's very sad.
I'm trying to think of some kind of joke about, like, AI or whatever, but mostly I'm just sorry that Reagan's sick.
Why the fuck would you joke about my sick dog, you sick man?
Hey, I would never even dream of doing so. I think it's like we felt like there was this giant thing approaching us because we both knew that, like, the end of Metal Gear Solid 2 is something, and we both had some idea of it. And then over the past couple weeks, especially last week with Thor, we kept kind of guessing at things, and they were like, you are going to have a lot to talk about next week. And we're finally here, and we finally do have a lot to talk about, and who better to join us than Harper J, currently of Double Fine, formerly a video games writer that I respect very much, wrote for Kotaku, wrote for many other places, as sometimes happens, and has written a book on Metal Gear, in this case, Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, but has done a lot of long-form pieces on Metal Gear Solid as well. Harper, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Am I given to understand by everything you're saying that this is your first time playing Metal Gear Solid 2?
This is both of our first times playing both Metal Gear Solid 1 and 2.
That's fascinating.
Well, I'd played the Zone of the Enders demo about 40 times.
I mean, that's like a huge portion of the game right there, the most important portion of the game.
So technically, it was my first time playing 1.90... This joke's not going anywhere, let's just move on.
It's alright. That's kind of cool. I mean, I've had a couple friends this year who have also picked up... I don't know what it is about this year. Maybe it's just Kojima season, but I've had some friends who have also played through it, and I've watched them play through, and no one guesses it. Nobody's prepared for it. Partially because it's both a cool, prescient thing, and also just no one knows what, like, this game wants to say a bunch of things, and then sometimes you're like, you read some articles, you read, like, a little bit of The Selfish Gene, and that's kind of the end of it, but it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, it's almost, despite the past 20 years' best efforts to spoil it for me, it just feels kind of impossible. You know, it's like, I had heard, okay, the Colonel's an AI. I had heard, okay, you fight the former president. Like, I had been given many pieces of what happens at the end of this game, but, like, even if someone just wrote out, like, here are literally all the things that happen, I don't think they would be able to actually spoil, like, the experience of having it happen, because it is just, like, so many things crashing into each other at once in a way that kind of can't be communicated other than playing it.
Listen, some of those things you mentioned, Colonel being an AI, the battle with Solidus, the reason you know about those is that's mimesis, baby. Those are the strongest memes of Metal Gear Solid 2.
The DNA of the soul!
Yeah.
We've been kind of playing this in chunks. We've been playing it like a book club, and so, strictly speaking, this episode is going to go from basically EE's insertion of the virus and death to the end of the game. But I do want to kind of talk about it as a project. I want to, you know, do the whole thing. Here is my question for Blake Hester. You, I think, have done your best to really engage in good faith with this game that you have not generally enjoyed playing. Do you still feel that way? Did you like the ending, or are you just a very smart guy who comes to this podcast, you know, in good heart and is ready to engage with it? Or were you like, this slams?
Well, I am a very smart guy who comes to this podcast every week in good faith with no little tricks up my sleeve. And it is true that the middle chunk of this game really just did little for me. But then the final 2 hours, brother, Kojima pulled out that big old narrative gun he wielded like Fortune, and he said, time to do some good writing. And my God, I was all in. When this game like kind of turns into, I don't know, a technophobic horror game for a little while, I was all in. I was like, this is my shit. I am super engaged with everything this is trying to do narratively and thematically. And aside from the final boss fight, which I found mechanically quite poor, I thought the ending of this game was stellar. And I didn't particularly like the game. That's fine. You know, that's just the risk you take going into games blind like this. But I think the final 2 hours were just knocked it out of the park. Like, I was losing my mind last night playing through this, having a ball.
Can I ask a question?
What's up?
Because I tried to go into this conversation kind of blind to your experiences or feelings. Were you immediately on board with Raiden, Blake? Or were you like, I don't know quite what's happening here?
Oh, I mean, I had long known the switch to Raiden.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know. It's not a great answer, but, like, I just knew to expect it. So when it happened, I was like, okay, here's the moment. You know?
Okay, yeah.
I found Raiden an interesting character. I found him and Rose's relationship to be very compelling. Up front, I am very much not a fan of Kojima's style of writing when it comes to like character work and dialogue. So a lot of that, you know, was very eye-rolly for me just because I don't particularly like the way he writes his dialogue.
Do you remember what day it is tomorrow?
Yeah, yeah. So you get where I'm coming from. But I do think like I enjoy Raiden in terms of his place in what the game is trying to say. And I do like that, you know, that switch happens, especially by the end when shit goes haywire.
Yeah, I think it's like, it is weird to have a game that is just so much defined by its ending. But like, the whole Raiden thing, I feel like it pays out like a slot machine, because you could not do this ending with Solid Snake. You know, there's no version of the monologue that Campbell and Rose could give to Snake that would kind of hit as hard as it does being delivered to Raiden, and that is because of the whole like Raiden experience through the whole game. And so I also knew, it's like, I knew you switched to Raiden, I knew that people didn't like it. I think I came in more ready to engage with the weird thing the game was doing rather than having a blast with the Solid Snake power fantasy. But it's hard for me to imagine getting to the end of this game and still being mad that they made you be Raiden, because it's just like, that's when it's hitting you in the face with the idea that it was the whole point that you were Raiden.
Harper, I'll be interested to hear your experience playing this the first time, but Jacob, I think for our sake, like, having that step removed just by knowing the switch was going to happen and just being willing to like engage with it, I think the antagonism of the creator in this game and making fun of like you wanting the kind of power fantasy, it made it easier to engage with that and like have that step removed to be like, okay, what is he saying about the people who would get mad? Because it seems like a lot of this game is made in preparation of frustrated players.
Yeah.
And not having to worry about that is like, you get to be kind of a passive observer of what Kojima was saying, because it's like, well, I'm not really the target audience here. Harper, when did you play this game originally? Did you know about the Switch?
Oh boy. No, I didn't know about it, right? So, like, I played this when it came out, and that means I was, like, 10 or 11, which means I'm old now. But at the time, I was a youngin', and, you know, my experience with Metal Gear is kind of a case study, I think, in a lot of the American audience's experience with Metal Gear, in the sense that I first played Metal Gear Solid on a demo disc for PlayStation Magazine, and that, I think that was literally just, like, getting into Shadow Moses, like that whole segment. It's just, I think, the dock and the heliport, to the best of my recollection. It's also, it's a section that, do you know any? I shouldn't say anything about Metal Gear Solid 4. No, I can't.
Oh, look, Metal Gear Solid 4 was the first Metal Gear Solid game that I played. So I started with that.
Yeah, so there's a whole point in that game where they kind of like, that whole segment is in it again, like quite literally. And so, that's interesting to me, and I don't know if it's particularly intentional on Kojima's part, right? A thing, I want to be careful in conversations that we have today, or like broadly speaking about Metal Gear, where I think people both rightly and wrongly attribute a lot of intentionality to Kojima, because sometimes he's very clearly doing things deliberately. But sometimes, and I say this as somebody who has devoted a lot of time writing about his works, sometimes I think he's just kind of a fool who bumbles into things. So that's part of the truth too. But for me, to go back to the question, I played the demo disc and then played the first Metal Gear Solid. That was a big deal. Like, there were small things about that game looking back now that I remember reading reviews. People were like, oh yeah, there's like heartbeats and the controller vibrates like the heartbeat, right? Like, stuff that we would take for granted nowadays. We have, you know, resistive haptic feedback on our PlayStation controllers or whatever. It's small stuff like that that really starts to paint the image of, oh, this is doing something. It's both, it's first off, it's that, oh, this is doing something with the medium, which is interesting, which is, it calls attention to itself constantly, which is a huge important thing for Metal Gear Solid 2. And then also, we're still in that area of time where it's like, this is political, man. That's for adults, man. Oh my gosh, games are doing it. But, you know, as a 10 or 11 year old, I just thought it was fun to play. Some of the points weren't entirely lost on me, but how much can I really comment? You know, how much commentary on the American experience, on the Imperial Project, can I really respond to when I am barely beginning to develop a true formative idea of myself? I can't really, but I used to play this game like over weekends, like all the time, right? I can quote this script with frightening accuracy. And that's both a good thing and a terrible thing.
It's funny that you say that about playing as a kid, because one of the thoughts that I had while playing this, and something that I actually don't think I've said on the pod, is that I bought, like, I had a PS2 and I bought this game and I played through the tanker section when I was probably 13, 14 years old, and just something else caught my attention and I didn't ever finish it. I didn't get past the end of the tanker until now. And I am retroactively so mad at myself, because I loved this game. I loved the ending. Playing it now, I think if I played this when I was 14 years old, it would have defined my personality in a way where maybe it's good that it didn't, because I would have been even more annoying.
Bad news about, like, a huge portion of the gamer audience and a huge portion of the internet audience and, like, tons of dirtbag leftist types, like, they did let this game define a huge portion of their
right.
personality, and for some of them, they've never let go.
Yeah, and I, you know, so obviously it is, like, looking at alternate futures is always a little bit scary, and, like, I'm very happy with my life now, and so I probably wouldn't change it, but in the same way as, recently I watched Danny Boyle's film Sunshine, and I really loved Sunshine, and I also thought, if I saw this at 14 years old, it would have been one of my favorite movies ever. And just, like, I really appreciated what was going on here, and I think it would have, at kind of the dawning of my political consciousness, it would have hit me 100 times harder, and maybe it's good that it didn't, because I don't actually want my entire ideology defined by Kojima kind of repeating the selfish gene.
I like the alternate timeline where you played this game when you were 14 years old and became a dirtbag left podcaster. I think that would have been really funny.
To be clear, I don't want to, I mean, I say that a little derisively, but you can certainly trace a path from this game to obviously something like Blowback Pod or something, like Noah Colwyn and those people, in the sense that
they named all the recent episodes
yes,
of
they,
the season
I mean,
after
they
Metal
episodes
Gear
of that
games.
Are just called Snake Eater. Yeah. But I think in the sense too that they, presumably they're like around our age as well. I don't know how old those groups are, but it's definitely this case of, for some people, it is a piece of slightly more anti-imperialist, anti-American media, which, you know, this game releases in what, 2001? It releases
right after 9/11.
After September 11th, they have to change portions of the ending of this game. They remove stuff from this game, right? Originally, the Statue of Liberty was going to get displaced and moved and a bunch of weird stuff.
Like Cloverfield.
Yeah, 100%. A little bit. And so...
Kojima predicted Cloverfield!
Yeah, so having that sort of game presented to you at a very impressionable age during charged moment in American history in regards to kind of the American psyche is kind of interesting, right? And you do see that ripple effect out in pop culture now that we have people who are reaching the point of being creative.
I don't exactly know where I'm going with this, but I really had just like a weird moment yesterday. And I'm sorry, I feel like I've spent this season being kind of a Kojima hater, which is ironic considering how much of a defender of Death Stranding I am. But
I don't think you have. I think you've honestly given him a lot of kudos for someone who's not getting along with these games.
I think, Harper, what you're saying is so valuable to hear for me, because this game strikes me as a great gateway game into like bigger ideas. You know, I think like Jacob, you were saying if you played this when you were 14, like it would have blown your mind. I finished this game for the first time and saw Stalker for the first time in the same day, which are really interesting pieces of media to experience in, within 5 hours of each other. And I think where I kind of push back on this game is like the pedestal it's kind of put upon as this genius piece of like prescient or future predicting media, more so just like an interesting gateway and an interesting example of political narratives in games. Does this make sense? Like, I hate the way it's kind of always projected as this, like, or the way it's kind of held up as maybe smarter than it is, where I, coming to it for the first time at nearly 30, I see it as like, wow, this is a really cool example of a game trying to take the medium more seriously beyond just like interesting or quirky mechanics. But it doesn't strike me as like, you know, Stalker was a revelatory moment for me. Metal Gear Solid 2 was not.
I think it's, I think there are a couple ways that we can come at this. One of the really enjoyable things about finishing this game is there is so much long form good writing about Metal Gear Solid 2 in the way that does not often exist about games that release now, or if they do, they're kind of on YouTube videos or other places that are kind of harder to research and track down. But I've been reading a lot of people's pieces about this. And I think what the place that I've come to, and Harper, I want to know if you agree with this, is like the stuff that it has to say about the American government is interesting political writing that is not, you know, radically more forward thinking than a lot of other writing at the time. What it is doing with itself as a game remains, like, its commentary on games, I think, is fundamentally more interesting and more novel than its commentary on American.
Yes,
I fully agree.
Yes, 100%. So I'll say a couple things, which is to start us off, I'll say something which sounds unflattering, but has stayed kind of like a splinter in my mind ever since I've heard it. I believe this was my friend Jackson Tyler of Abnormal Mapping. I think they said something to the effect once of the idea that some of the best stories told in video games are still a thing that you would buy at like an airport bookstore.
Yes.
And yes. I know that sounds really damning to the medium. I mean, we're here on a podcast talking about games, treating them seriously. Jacob, you may have a huge footprint now, I would say, kind of informing people, informing the ways that they think about games seriously and have imaginative and interpretive kind of analyses of them. And you know, I think games are wonderful, but at the same time, I don't know, they're not, this isn't a novel thing that's being said about America, right? It's not, it's the bare minimum to look at the American project and say that there's a problem here, or to say that, hey, this thing is not a thing controlled by, like, the deterministic will of a collective people, but really a very privileged group of powerful folks. That's like surface level stuff. I think I fundamentally agree that this is more interesting as a game about games, which is kind of a reductive way to talk about it. But I think Kojima is a way better game designer than he's a writer. That's the truth of Death Stranding.
Yes,
as well.
Yeah.
Blake, you said that you like Death Stranding. I really adore Death Stranding, but I don't. I think there are moments in there which are very, very human. I think Kojima sometimes has a way of grasping upon melodrama in a way that's important. People sort of deride melodrama sometimes and say, oh, it's not as serious, but our emotions are very important things, and we should embrace them.
We're huge fans of the Yakuza games here. We love melodrama.
But what Death Stranding is doing in terms of a shared infrastructure, in terms of what it means to build a path for another player and how that ties into the themes of that game, that's way more interesting than, you know, Die Hardman talking to you for 20 minutes. That's the absurd stuff. And that's kind of the same case here, where, Jacob, you're talking about writing about this game, and I don't know if you ever got around to it, but when I in a fit of late night fury, I forgot that I had never sent this to you, which was James Howell's piece.
Oh, I read it.
Metal Gear Solid 2, which is called Driving Off the Map, for those at home who have not heard about this piece. Driving Off the Map, James Howell. It's possibly, I would say, one of the most just really honed and focused pieces of formal textual criticism for video games in terms of saying, hey, this is what it means to repeat a space from game to game. This is what it means to repeat verbs from game to game. What does it mean that, in Metal Gear Solid 1, you defeat Metal Gear Rex by, pointing your Stinger missile and shooting, and then the next time you defeat a Metal Gear in the tanker, you're just taking pictures, but it's the same mechanical thing that you're doing. What does it mean to have, the Vulcan Raven arena functionally recreated when you're fighting Fat Man? And what does that contrast mean? And that's part of the plot. The plot is like Ocelot being like, actually, you were inside Shadow Moses the whole time, baby. But in terms of what that means for the mechanics, it's very important. And that's the more interesting stuff, I think, that's happening in Metal Gear Solid 2 to me than anything else that happened.
We spent so much time talking about the repeated motifs of this game and how much we could give them kudos for being intentional and how much it feels like just returning to the same old bag of tricks. And it's like, if you want to give them the maximum kind of like, if you want to engage with them as if every single decision was absolutely intentional, which I do think is a good way of engaging with a piece of art, Howell's essay is remarkable for that, in terms of just like tracking every way that it is mirrored and inverted and whatever. And it is the kind of thing that the end of this game then begs you to think about. It's not subtle in terms of like when it tells you this is what it's doing, but if you really want to dig in there and find every little piece of when that is happening and why, he does an incredibly good job at doing that.
It's that right there that I found so like infinitely compelling about the final 2 hours of this game, is all of that stuff coming to a head, more so than, we had a fight in the financial district of Manhattan. What does that mean? It's like, I don't really care. But all of this stuff as kind of a frustrated sequel, I think is like really incredible stuff.
Harper, I want to ask you about a line that is in your piece on Kotaku, which is a long-form piece that you wrote on it. You did one on MGS1 as well. And did you do ones on the original Metal Gears?
I did them on the MSX ones too. And then I was going to do the rest, and I was like, no, I should leave. I should get out of this.
Look, a good call for your own well-being.
Yeah.
But you said early on, and I wrote this line down, and I was like, I really want to talk about this. As you said, Metal Gear Solid 2's fear is that player behavior undermines the craft of the artist, which I just like, I would love for you to kind of expand on that and let us kind of inform how we talk about what this game is doing towards the ending.
Yeah, so my fundamental position on games is that the player is a very antagonistic presence. I've used this framework, it makes it sound funny, but that starting position has informed a lot of criticism I've done, a lot of public speaking I've done, and for good and for ill, some people follow me on it, and some people get very upset when I suggest this. A phrase I've used from time to time is this idea that players are tyrants. There is a controlled space which exists, and we impose a great deal of control over it. And that control sometimes runs contrary to, say, like, what a character wants. We can make characters do things that they don't want to do. And that there's something very interesting about that to me. And it's also very interesting to me in the moments when a player and, like, a character want the same thing. Which is to say, sometimes they might not want it for the same reasons, but when we are more aligned with the characters that we are controlling, I think that's very interesting, and I think the times when we are not, when there's frictions, is equally interesting. And then when it comes to the idea of a player kind of rubbing up against the work of a creator, I think there's a degree to which game storytelling positions itself, or you know, eventually, like, especially in this era, starts to position itself, and now that we have our AAA, HBO, whatever the hells, really positions itself as, like, serious, intentional storytelling. But there's no way that an author could, and a great deal of Metal Gear Solid 2 seems to be preparing itself for the ways in which the player might rebel against what they're being told, what they're being asked to do. And I think, I don't know if there's a fully antagonistic relationship between the game Metal Gear Solid 2 and the player, but there is something there. There is a kind of antagonism where I think very often the player is asked to do things that they just would rather not.
Yeah, like swim through that flooded hallway twice.
Yes, there's a lot of intentional points of friction, and I don't fully know what to make of it, whether or not the idea is, if you push through that, then, like, you're one of the true soldiers who did it, baby. But there's a way in which I think this game, more than most games at the time, is really kind of putting up the defenses against the player, because it does want to say something, and I think it's very afraid that the player will devalue that message through some type of shenanigans.
Yeah, I think, you know, not to I don't want to fight a man who I respect and is also dead, but, like, Roger Ebert's video game art thing, which people talked about a huge amount 10 years ago and now has kind of faded away, wasn't that he didn't say video games aren't art because I think they're stupid. He was like, video games aren't art because they are essentially, like, uncontrolled environments that, like, when you're making a movie, you can control exactly what the person is going to see and experience. And when you're making a game, you can't do that. I think it's a curious way to define what is and is not art. But, like, I do like the idea that that, like, these same things are what Metal Gear Solid 2 is kind of trying to figure out. I think let's just start talking through the events that happen in this section, and then we will certainly get to kind of big ideology points and big parts of design, and we can spend a while on there. Here's probably the worst thing in the game to me is getting the backstory on EE and
Omnia. Yeah, brother. Yeah. Preach. My God. I think this game would, if EE would have been anyone else, not Otacon's sister, I think the game would have been just fine not having this entire plot line. I think it really gets lost in the sauce here and bogs down, like, what is leading up to a really great moment when we have to, like, spend time watching Otacon cry in hallways.
If there's one thing about the Metal Gear Solid series that I've never been fully great at untangling or understanding what the read is, it's everything involving the Emmerich family. Starting here and then extending all the way to, like, the Phantom Pain. I don't know what to think about this whole stuff. I don't know what to think about Huey Emmerich in general when we get there in those games. It's I don't know why. I don't understand.
It seems like the writing is, it's like there is an emotional core that I feel like the story should be pushing towards, even if I don't think it's that interesting. But it's like, you can see it's there, which is, you know, Otacon feels guilt. Essentially, like, that's the whole thing. Like, the Emmerich thing is, oh, we feel guilt about designing these war machines, and now also we feel guilt because, like, the sister died and it was kind of his fault, you know? And it's like, what if you want to have it there, and then he cries because he feels like he never got to resolve things with her, that's fine. But then they throw in just so many plot points that send your head spinning in a way that is not like, oh my gosh, what does this new information mean? It just, like, completely deadens the emotions, because we find out that EE, you know, she's scared of water. She almost drowned in the pool. Otacon didn't help because he was having an affair with his stepmother, that he was sleeping with his stepmother at the time that EE was drowning in the pool, and that EE's father did not die simply because he, like, died trying to save her, but killed himself in the same pool because of the affair, ? And it's just kind of like, it's like, what the fuck am I supposed to do with all that? You know, like, how am I supposed to, like, read that into the story?
Jacob, I got the answer. Don't. Just move past it. That's what I did.
Water off a duck's back.
This will sound like a weird phrase to say. Putting aside the issue of taste, which you can't.
Right.
It's a weird thing to do, but also, it just, even if you rearranged it so it wasn't quite the same configuration of facts, I don't know what it offers to the story entirely, because I don't think you need another reason for Otacon to feel such estrangement from Emma. This is just another added layer to it that is very odd to me. And also, no thanks, I don't want any part of it.
Yeah, and I think it also, like, at its most basic, or maybe just a bare bones criticism, is like, this is such a weird moment to drop this revelation because it grinds the pacing to a halt.
Yep.
And, like, we're building up towards a climax, and so much shit is going to happen in quick succession that this, like, detour for 20 minutes, like, starts to kind of suck the wind out of the sails a bit. And also, it's just dumb, if you ask me.
The plot point in general of all this, too, is, and this is something that kind of gets repeated in Metal Gear Solid 4, which is kind of odd, is there's a lot of ways in which Otacon's experience in the series is really defined by his relationship to women who essentially die for him in one way or shape or another. And it's really silly, because we have this with Sniper Wolf, and okay, whatever, that's, like, he's infatuated with Sniper Wolf. Who wouldn't be? She's a sniper. She likes dogs. It's great.
Yep.
And then she dies, and that is a character point for him. And this happens again with Emma. This happens again with another character in Metal Gear Solid 4 as well. And it doesn't seem necessary to me, because if there's one thing I actually really enjoy about this game, broadly speaking, is I like Otacon in this game a ton. I love the relationship he has with Snake. I love how he's grown into himself. And I'm fine with there being familial drama between him and Emma, but the pattern that we have kind of starting to repeat here throughout is just, it's the same plot with Otacon a lot, just different kind of variations on that theme, and it's one of the bigger fumbles in the series for me.
Yeah, it really just feels like it is the point in the game where Otacon needs to be sad about a dead girl.
Yes.
It's like it's about that time, and we've got to get it happening. But then I will say, a good thing is that he and Snake have a really complicated secret handshake.
Yes, they
which
do.
They do, which I found very entertaining.
They love each other. They're great.
But we, fortunately, we don't have to dwell on that for too long, because a bunch of shit starts happening right away. Raiden gets betrayed, maybe, by Snake and Olga. There's the line where...
You're switching sides now? switching sides.
Yeah, or whoever side
I don't
was
recall
on
saying I was ever on your side, like that stuff, right? And this is also you finally see that the cyborg ninja is Olga. And if you hadn't put that together by now, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, we find out the cyborg ninja's Olga. Oh my gosh. Big Shell just fully falls apart. The whole idea of like making sure it doesn't blow up because it would be an environmental catastrophe. It's gone. Though I think there is some line about like they actually hadn't done so much cleanup, so it doesn't really matter.
I almost said Ocelot. Otacon gets the hostages out there who are there. There are actual hostages, and he does get them onto his helicopter and gets them out of there. Right, like that's his big thing. Things like you gotta do it for me, buddy. And so he does that as well. So a lot of loose threads are kind of removed from the stage because now we got to get to the real juicy, weird stuff.
Yeah, but then in case every other element of the game repeating itself had been too subtle for you, suddenly we are just back in the torture room of Metal Gear Solid 1 doing a very similar torture minigame, which is something that I did not know was coming. And Ocelot says you're in the memory of Shadow Moses. Like, theoretically, you were on Arsenal Gear, but in no way does it read as like, yes, I'm inside a big ship right now. It just reads as like, I have been transported back in memory to the previous game.
I would say mechanically it repeats, right? Because you have to do your own kind of variation of the torture sequence. This is another case of Raiden going through the same beats as Snake, the player repeating those beats again, and kind of repeating those mechanics as a way to almost a really bizarre pilgrimage upon the path of the hero, walk like them until you become them kind of way, right?
Yeah, except Raiden is somewhat humiliated in this because he is completely naked and they do the Austin Powers / Simpsons movie thing of like blocking his dick with random items in the room.
Very good.
Which I quite enjoyed. But we do find out a lot of backstory on Raiden here, and this is like another big important beat is like he hasn't wanted to tell Rose about anything from his past, and what we know about him has been like, oh, he's this nerd who did a bunch of VR missions and he thinks he's a real soldier. But in fact, we find out not the case at all. He was a child soldier. He was like a very brutal child soldier who like killed a whole bunch of people without remorse using a sword. And he is Solidus's son or Solidus is his godfather. Son.
Well, not literally. It's a later reveal on the top of the building. Where Solidus is like, hey, I killed your parents.
Oh, right.
That comes later.
Right.
But yeah, so Solidus is out there as the president being like, I really want to do some war crimes in Liberia. And I will make all these children do it. And I will take them from their families and have a bunch of child soldiers. Child soldiers, a topic that comes up in a couple of Metal Gear Solid games. I don't mean that dismissively. In Metal Gear Rising, a big part of Phantom Pain as well, it's clearly a topic that Kojima cares about. I will never accuse Hideo Kojima of not caring about things.
Sure.
Yeah.
I will sometimes accuse him of perhaps not fully educating himself on certain things, although he at least makes the efforts, right? I will never suggest that he doesn't make the effort, but he definitely cares about things. He cares about nuclear deterrence. He cares about children in war zones in a way that I think is very genuine.
The Kojima, I'm trying to think of the way to say this. I'm not going to say anything bad, just I don't know how to like phrase it. The running thread of Kojima games and children I've been thinking about a lot with like child soldiers, the gene stuff, like, hey, have some kids and pass on your passions to them or whatever. And then Death Stranding in general. I don't have a question, but what's going on with this guy?
I think he thinks a lot about, I mean, a major theme of this game is like, what do we pass on? Or the first game, what do we pass on genetically? Right. This game, what do we pass on culturally, you know, memetically? Death Stranding then just seems to be like, hey, what if you were a father for a whole game? What would that be
that's
like?
That's a game about a bunch of dads and like one mom.
and the mom is named Mama. I think at first I was going to say that child soldiers almost feel like it's not like it's a bad thing to care about. I would never say that, but it is almost so simplistic of a topic that I was going to be like, okay, we all agree they're bad. Kind of what is the purpose of doing them here? But I think that is actually not giving it enough credit, because there is such a running thread here of culture making people into soldiers, and video games being a medium primarily consumed by children, and like so much talk about how video games are training for war. And later Raiden says, you know, they made us watch action movies with macho guys to like, you know, image training to get us ready to be fighters. I do think there is this kind of implicit connection, and maybe explicit connection, between you know, Raiden being a child soldier growing up and then continuing to do violence, and the way that Kojima clearly does think a lot about how media is affecting our view of violence and our view of like what being a soldier
and
means.
I mean, like, this is something we talk about a lot on this show, is the video game to army pipeline. I mean, Jacob, no disrespect to your main man, but like Top Gun Maverick, they have plenty of deals with the Air Force. You know what I'm saying? Like
sure do.
The Army buys ad spots on IGN and GameSpot. Just the way it goes. I think this game is interesting in that it's doing it very early, before I think Call of Duty brought this, you know, more into the public conscience. But like, I buy the idea that Raiden would just be like a trained on media and want to kill because of it. I remember going to a GDC talk years ago, maybe I've talked about it before, where a guy who was a veteran talked about young kids joining because of Call of Duty, and they wanted to do hoorah shit. You know, I think that was his, like, quote. I was like, well, it's not necessarily how the army works. A lot of these kids would be disappointed about how would join and be very disappointed in how boring, you know, the day-to-day of the army is. Should be clear, just don't join the army is my take on that. But I like, and I buy into the idea that like Raiden would be force-fed all this like entertainment to prepare him for like killing. I don't necessarily think it's like maybe the most true to life thing. I don't know that like they're showing dudes Rambo in the barracks. Maybe they are. I don't know. I've never been in the army.
Hey, look, a lot of people watched Top Gun and signed up for the Air Force.
That's true. Yeah.
Even though he's in the Navy.
I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't think that's necessary. Anyway, regardless, I like this plot point is what I'm trying to say. And I think if there is anything prescient in this game, it is the idea that maybe video games would be used as recruitment tools, even if it wasn't in 2001. Though I don't exactly know if they were or not.
I think if it wasn't layered with the initial part of Snake especially showing so much derision for Raiden when he talks about his VR training, if it was just Raiden being like, oh, actually my past as a child soldier, and it didn't have the initial the first complication of, well, the first thing we thought about him was that he was just playing Metal Gear Solid VR missions for PlayStation 1 the entire time, I wouldn't accept it as much. It would feel a little almost like shocky for shocky's sake, right? Because there's a world in which you just kind of have that, and it kind of exists in and of itself. But when you combine it with the VR stuff, when you do have him talking about things like movies, or even, I mean, it's a small thing, but it's like, they're like, hey, we put gunpowder in your food, dog. Like, everything that you consume that we gave to you was somehow tainted by one way or another, by the mechanisms of war, by the product of war.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Raiden doesn't even have... He doesn't even have his own blood in this game. Like, they took out his blood and gave him different blood.
something we're not talking about, though, that I find interesting is, like, Kojima is commenting not just on the industry itself, but he's commenting on himself, which I find very interesting, because he is making violent games with badass dudes on the surface, right? And I think, like, I don't want to speak for the man. I only know the text I've been given here. But it seems like there is some kind of reckoning, him reckoning with himself there and his role in it. I don't know if he necessarily feels guilty or whatever the case may be. But I think, like, he does see, if not this game, definitely MGS1, as, like, playing into that. It's easy to, like, think you could play MGS1 and be like, Snake's so fucking cool, I want to be a special ops guy, you know?
No, it's totally, I mean, it's like, I've been thinking about MGS1 has the you like all the killing, don't you? Where the game accuses you of enjoying in the violence and the like bloodlust that's in the game, and that was in 1998. Since then, we have seen a lot of games do the same thing to the point where it's almost lost all meaning. You know, when the final boss of an Uncharted guy says, like, think about how many people you've killed. I'm like, I don't care. That doesn't ring true for me. Something that I've been thinking about with Metal Gear Solid 2 is that this is almost, it feels like the only way to actually progress that commentary. You know, it is fairly easy to say, you enjoy all the killing, don't you? And have that be kind of the thing that your game is saying about violence. And Metal Gear Solid 2 is such a bizarre and sometimes hostile object because it really feels like it is trying to continue that conversation, like take it one more step beyond it. And that's kind of what makes it so confounding, because you have to get into this really weird space to be like, where do we go after we acknowledge that video games make killing fun? And it turns out you have to go to the system for societal sanity, whatever.
I also think the reason it works in MGS2 is a simple show, don't tell approach. You know, like, it's the easy escape.
They do a lot of telling in that
right,
game.
But, like, bear with me here, Jacob. It's the easiest scapegoat in the world, but, like, I don't care that Kratos feels sad in God of War 2018 because he killed Medusa. I just don't give a shit. I never will. I don't think that game did a good job of, like, approaching that topic. However, Metal Gear Solid 2 is like, here's some footage of the army juxtaposed against, like, video game footage. And it's like, it's more explicit, it's more beat over your head, but I also think it makes that message work better by just, like, putting it in your face. By, like, showing you exactly what Kojima's thinking on the screen, rather than, like, hinting at it or having a character tell you how. Do you get what I'm trying to say here?
I think at the core, too, it's a bit of the, it's like the François Truffaut quote, right? Like, there's no such thing as an anti-war movie. And whether or not you believe that's true, I don't know if I entirely buy that logic, but there is something, there is an inherent power to the image, right? That no matter what context you place it in, no matter what commentary you attach to it, there's an inherent animalistic power to images that speaks in and of itself beyond what we might want them to actually be saying. I think a lot of creators who make stuff that is nominally anti-war struggle with this problem. This is kind of famously like the whole arc of Yoshiyuki Tomino's thing with Gundam, right? Is like, I made this anti-war thing and now it's like very toyetic. And it culminates in some very interesting stuff in Turn A Gundam, which is very funny, but we're not here to talk about Gundam. But it is this thing of, you know, just in the same way that like critiques of capitalism get consumed by capitalism, right? Critiques of war end up getting consumed by the facilitators of war, right? And we see that in languages of like, you know, oh, less lethal, even that, like that sort of language or things like that, right? Like no matter how you position it, there's like even just the power of the image of the gun, right? Like there is something there which you could place that image into whatever vicious context you want. And the raw image of the gun, for whatever reason, just evokes something beyond the critique that maybe we want to attach.
No, I've been, I can't remember where I read this. It might have just been like a Reddit thread, but I read someone kind of theorizing about like one of the reasons that MGS4 maybe kind of spins so far off the rails is like between 2 and 4, you essentially have the advent of Call of Duty, which is just so like unbelievably forthright with like the kind of subtle critiques of media that Kojima was kind of trying to do, that it's like, what do you even do after, like, you know, Call of Duty exists in the world? Like, how do you write about like video games being about war and creating false ideas of war when Call of Duty already exists and is, like, doing the thing that you were trying to comment on to an exponentially higher degree than games were doing when you started talking about this.
There's a point where you ask yourself, like, what the fuck are we doing? Yeah. I don't know if you can swear, but I'm sorry.
Correct.
And I feel this about video games very often, right, where I see all sorts of different patterns in it, and I go, I don't know if this is worth it. And I think the way, like, Call of Duty in and of itself, like, no judgment to the people working on those games, whatever, you're all individuals, I don't know what you're up to, maybe you need money, you need to live, I get it, we all live in a society, but it's such a, yeah, I guess I'll just kind of say it, right, like, I don't need to be polite, I think it's such a damning scar on the industry and everything we kind of pretend that the industry can be, when really, it's the money-making franchise, and it really does boil to, and I mean it says something that the money-making franchise, yep, is just war the game.
Whew. Well, so Raiden Super Naked, and after this the section ends, Raiden remains super naked. I really don't think there's so he's a child soldier. But there is this whole section where you're running around and he's covering his crotch with his hands, which means that you, like, you can't do anything. You can't, like, knock out guards or, like, hang from ledges or whatever. And you can still cartwheel around and do all this stuff. And my partner Annie said something that I think she mostly meant as a joke, but it really made me think, where she was like, he looks like a Barbie. Like, he looks, it almost doesn't feel... It feels like even though he is covering his crotch, it really doesn't feel like he would have genitalia under there at all. He is such this kind of, like, weird. Yeah, I mean, it's like, if you break the camera. And it's like you can see all of these, like, kind of unclear, but, like, looks like essentially cyber markings on his body where he maybe has, like, prosthetic or enhanced limbs or something. And it is this weirdly, like, it is... extremely vulnerable for him, but it's also kind of dehumanizing because you recognize that, like, that's not what a naked human being looks like.
Yeah, I think, I don't know what potential conversations you might have had when you were first introduced to Raiden, but I think there is a way in which he very clearly represents a different kind of idealized form of, mm-hmm, like, the human body. A thing that's super present in Kojima's work is just the ways in which male bodies get fetishized. Obviously, women bodies, too. Not to take away from the way in which Kojima's camera tends to leer at women. Because there is a difference, right? Like, his camera leers at women, but his camera admires men in a very specific kind of way. But, I mean, part of it's just the compare contrast of rough soldier, tough guy Snake to beautiful human Raiden, right? And in the document of, of the game pre-production, some of that is about trying to draw in different audiences to the game. There is a very, I mean, this is true of everything when you're making a game, but there is a very deliberate way in which Raiden is crafted as a way to widen the demographic scope of Metal Gear Solid 2. And when you look at his body in this game, especially in this sequence, there is a way in which it is very manufactured. And also, there's kind of a theme in these games about scars and bodies too. There's a whole moment in Metal Gear Solid 3 where the villain will comment on your body depending on how damaged you have been throughout the game or things like that. And so, and it's almost damning, right? There's like the perfection of Raiden also speaks to the artifice of his, like, bravado in a certain way, like, hey, I'm the guy who's always been in war, but, like, what do you have to show for him? What have you? I mean, he has lots to show for in theory, but physically, he's very pristine.
Yeah, he is. Pristine is a great way of referring to it. That he just he does not look. He looks like a guy who's done a million VR missions and has never been on a battlefield. Very, essentially,
very pale. This is the White Devil, Jack the Ripper.
But you can only focus on Raiden's nudity for so long before Campbell just steals the stage here and starts going fucking loco in a scene that I knew was coming and yet did not disappoint in any way, shape,
Jacob
or form.
Glenn Geller, Glenn Ross. Did you Now, Campbell calls you, I would wager, 400 times to say some bananas gibberish, and it all rocks. Mm-hmm. Did you, however, call Campbell 400 times back?
Oh, yeah.
Because some wild shit starts happening. Mei Ling shows up at one point. At one point, your radar just turns into a sexy lady. There's a whole thing with the Konami Eyes girls that we haven't really probably got into.
I will say something about that moment, which is that if players hadn't noticed that the radar screen sometimes adopts views that the character would not necessarily have, that's the moment where it's very obvious. But this happens not the same way, but earlier, like if you shoot a piece of glass and a guard sees the glass that's broken, like on the tether, it will show that in your little radar screen. So there's a way in which that space has never been entirely literal, but maybe players don't really notice it until they finally go, here's the sexy lady.
Well, I sure noticed it when the sexy lady popped up, because I was like, what's going on in the corner of that? At one point, he starts just reading the etymology of certain flowers, I believe. It's the coolest shit that's ever been in a game, ever. No offense to every other game, but step it the fuck up.
It's so good. The music is perfect in the scene and how unnerving it is. There's the most famous one, I think, is if you call him while you're fighting all the Metal Gears, he says something about like seeing a worm in space and I need scissors 69, like that sort of thing. But my favorite one was if you there's one time when you call him and he's just like, I'm so sorry for making you pay for lunch the other day. To tell you the truth, my finances are not doing well. And it's like, it's so weird in that, like, how normal it is. And the camera, another just like, oh, I would never have thought of this, but it is so weird and good, is before the camera starts showing that he has, like, a skull on his face, it just starts showing different angles of him where you've been calling him and you get the same angle of everyone's face on the codec the whole game. And then it's just like slightly lower, or you're looking at the back of his head or something. And it really is. It is that kind of like, I think this is something that Kojima is exceptionally good at from a game design standpoint of, you did not know that you could make this aspect into a, like emotional storytelling device, you know, that most people would see that and be like, that is purely gamic. You know, what is there in that to twist it into some way of like communicating an emotion? And nothing goes unused here. Everything is made weird in some unexpected way.
I also like that, like, it would be very easy to say, oh, we used EE's virus and now Metal Gear, we got it. But, like, the fact it infects the game is so cool. And, like, not what I expected. I didn't expect my game to start breaking around the idea that, like, we had uploaded a virus. I think that is so neat. And it's, like, it shows... Suriel said this about Killer 7's pause menu. He said, like, Suda understands everything is narrative. And that's how I feel about this moment. Is, like, having Campbell be in different angles in the codec, it's like, yes, everything is narrative, and it's so fucking cool.
I will deflate the bubble only ever so slightly to
say,
this is not the first time a character in a Metal Gear game has told the player to turn off the game. This happens in, I believe, Metal Gear? My recollection might be incorrect, but there is a moment where Big Boss calls you and is like, hey man, just turn it off, right? This is before you kind of know that Big Boss is the villain. It's very brief. I think this game does all this stuff very, very much better, obviously. But there's a lot of stuff that repeats in this game that's been done ever since the MSX as well. There have been electrified floors and like remote control missiles forever.
Oh, yeah.
In these games, for instance. So this is like a much more crystallized and well-considered version of what if we make the player wonder about the hardware to an extent too.
Counterpoint, I was born in 1994, so games don't exist before the PS2 to me.
That's fine.
So
that's fine.
The other ones didn't exist. It started here, as far as I'm concerned.
No, that's the American one. That's the American viewpoint anyway, right? There are no games before Metal Gear Solid.
Right. And hey, look, that's why they chose Raiden, is he never looks back and he never considers his history.
Yes.
Other things that I love here, the rooms in Arsenal Gear are named after body parts, which is essentially, we just played the scariest game ever made, Anatomy, on the show not long ago, and like the idea of you being in like the ascending colon is like, oh god, what's going on here? The thing, I guess, I mean, it's like there's so much good surreal writing going on here. They start showing different, Campbell just starts rattling off like different VR missions, you know, from previous games, and it will like show them and whatever. There is this whole conversation with Rose where Rose tells you that it was all just a game, but she did fall in love with you, but kind of not. And this whole time, it is really unclear what Rose is, where like Campbell is fully a construct, but like I was really struggling with, and this was in some parts hurt by playing Metal Gear Solid 4, in which Rose is like a real character who's there a bunch, but like it wants you to not know and to be kind of interrogating yourself as Raiden is about like, is Rose real at all? Is she real and just playing you? Is she actually in love with you? You know, what do you do with any of this? And Rose does not help with her calls.
The design document outlined a different version of this for the initial way that Metal Gear Solid 2 was going to do that, which was that Rose was initially going to be one of the hostages present on the Big Shell, and you would keep on trying to find her, and she would always just be not there, kind of princesses in another castle style, and that was going to be a mechanism by which the player was supposed to question whether or not Rose was actually like real. So that's always been kind of a goal from the earliest conceptions of the game, to kind of make the player doubt whether this person that, you know, Raiden supposedly has a fundamentally strong actual existing relationship with is real or not. I much prefer it when it's just somebody you're talking to on codec. The codec space in general is this space that like feels safe. It's the space we go to when we're like, switch to nano communications so nobody can listen to us. It's like a very private space, even within the fiction of the game. And to have it be a space where suddenly, like we were saying before, it can be infected and changed. Also, when you're eventually talking to Rose, she just gets disconnected. Like, you can just remove somebody from that space that you considered potentially safe before, excuse me. There's something very interesting.
Yeah. But we get through all of that, and suddenly, out of nowhere, Solid Snake shows up at his Solid Snakiest. He has never looked more cool. His bandana is blowing in the non-existent breeze. He looks exactly like the version of him that's in Super Smash Bros. Brawl. And
if you found the shaver and gave it to him, he's clean shaven here.
That's right. And he, you know, he gives you back your equipment and whatever. But easily the best line in this, at least from a kind of game breaking perspective, is that he says, hey, if you need some ammo, let me know. And then he points at his headband and says, infinite ammo, meaning that this snake has cheats turned on and he is just playing with the bandana that gives him infinite ammo.
Coolest shit of all time. Game rocks.
He gives you a sword. This is a big moment where, Harper, you write a lot in your
essay. I think it's one of the most
LA.
Important moments of the game and perhaps of the entire series.
Yeah, okay. I won't say what you said. Please, just tell us.
Oh, I think in a game about identity where the player has just been repeating all the stuff that Snake has done, both like in a sort of literal plot sense and then mechanically, it's super important that Raiden gets his own verbs and actions, right? Like, he gets to perform actions and express himself functionally, right, in a way that Snake never does. This is unique to him. It doesn't repeat later on in Metal Gear Solid 4 or anything. It is a unique mode of communication which is given to him, and that's big because I think the game is fundamentally incomplete if you do not have the player doing things that are physically, mechanically different at a certain point. Otherwise, you really are just an echo of Solid Snake. But you're not. You're Raiden. You're you. You're Jack. You're whatever. And you finally, I mean, it's towards the same goal, right? Like, the, if you boil down all these verbs and, like, to their core, it's like, what are you doing? You're killing. But that's reductive and boring and not always the best way to look at a thing. It's like, yeah, this is a form of expression given to the character, which has a little bit more range and variety to it as well. The way that you sweep and swipe or stab or spin. Very, very cool.
Yeah. And then, look, there are ways to look at it that are not simply killing, but it is unavoidable that the next sections of the game, you kill so many people. It becomes a full-on action game. There is no more stealth. You and Snake just run through rooms where dozens, if not hundreds, of dudes drop from the ceiling, and you just slice and dice through them all, and it is suddenly so much, like, gorier than the game has been before, and it, like, it really feels... I've certainly read, like, many pieces and seen pieces talking about kind of, like, this feels like the game giving you what you wanted from, like, the action game perspective of, like, here's your blockbuster, don't you like it? You're slicing dudes' arms off.
Because that's, like, such... That is one of, I think that's a boring read a little bit, right? Like, that's almost to the point where I want to be like, that's remedial, right? Like, because I don't think, I think it's wrong to view this game or the Metal Gear series entirely just through the lens of, like, player satisfaction or dissatisfaction. I think that's the popular myth, and I don't think it's as interesting necessarily.
So how would you read then the big kill rooms?
I mean, I don't know necessarily, but you know, my background's theater, right? And when emotions build to a certain point in musical that words no longer facilitate what the characters need to express themselves, they burst out into song. And in a game like this, in a setting like this, there's no real way for Raiden to express this coming into himself other than through an act of extraordinary violence.
I love it. I mean, I made the argument that Revengeance is a musical much more literally, because it is.
Yes.
But I really like the idea of this being them bursting into song. The game continues to do really weird things. It looks like you're game overed. It will say fission mailed.
Hey,
but you'll continue playing in, like, the little corner of the screen.
You can't do that. You can't mail fission. How was that? Was that good, right, y'all?
And that's how you know that it's good, fake. Y'all?
Did you have a sinking moment in your gut when you're like, did I just die? Oh my God.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There is a you know, relatively quick line here, but something that I have been thinking about in the couple days since I've beat this. This is one of the things that's, like, really stuck with me, is you get more of an explanation of what the kernel is and who you've been talking to, because the easy answer is it's an AI. It's not the real kernel, but it's an incomplete answer. And what they tell you actually here is that it is not simply a computer separate from you that has developed this character of the kernel and is talking to you. It is actually, like, cobbling together bits of Raiden's consciousness into, like, he has essentially created this character that he is talking to. And it is still an AI, and that it has a directive and it's trying to pull him in specific points. But, like, the ways that it communicates with him are kind of created by Raiden's own brain to be, like, the most effective ways of getting him to do things. And that feels like, if you want to start talking about kind of technology and algorithms with this game, that's actually one of the most interesting points for me of it, of, like, your own personalized something that is then guiding your behavior, and it's not the same for everyone, and it's actually sculpting that something out of bits of your pre-existing experiences. I loved that. I loved that the kernel was not simply a smart computer.
An incredibly fancy version of a large language model, right? Of just predicting the next thing that's expected to be said. I mean, it obviously does mean something that the expectation that Raiden puts together, and because Raiden's overlapping with the player, obviously it's just Campbell. Who's the guy I'm going to go out on missions with? Oh, it's going to be that fella. It's going to be the Colonel, who's really just the guy from Rambo.
And, like, you know, kind of, you could picture a different version, a different character might have someone who would treat them with a little more kindness or compassion or whatever, but, like, Raiden just creates this military guy who is going to kind of not let him explore his own emotions, because, like, that's not what they need at this point. Snake steals the Fortune boss fight from us. You think you're gonna fight Fortune finally. No, you don't. This is Snake's fight. You just have to climb up a ladder. So then we enter quite a moment. What you might think of as, here's the big turning point of the game, except there are four more to come. But you enter an arena that is in this totally abstract world that looks very much like the VR missions from Metal Gear Solid 1. And you're just left to kind of walk around there while a voice... Is it
it's Solidus.
Is it?
It's Solidus.
Okay, it's Solidus. Tells you that you've been in the S3 simulation, which stands for the Solid Snake Simulation, where everything that you've been experiencing has been crafted to turn you into the perfect soldier. That essentially, if they put you through the same events that Snake went through in Metal Gear Solid 1, you would turn into an equally effective soldier as him. It's all a training program. And then you fight 12 or 20 or 6 Metal Gear Rays. Blake, S3, Solid Snake Simulation. Were you like, make sense to me?
Yeah, so put me in there. I'm ready. Drop me in the SSS.
How'd you do with the Rays?
Easy boss fight. You just take the stinger, head, done. Easy. No, not a problem for me, pro gamer. You know, sometimes they get lost in the sauce of these proper nouns, and I just say, yep, I'm with you. Here we are.
A fascinating thing for me is that all the Metal Gears are codenamed Rows, essentially, in like different spellings.
RO2E, RO5E,
which was just something that I really...
If you play on Extreme, you have to defeat 20 of them.
Yeah, which I am personally glad I did not.
Yeah, a normal it's just 7, which is like way more reasonable.
I was on Easy and it felt like 30 of them, so I don't know what was up with that.
On Easy it's 5.
Okay. Well, I felt like 30.
Hey, still a lot. It's still 4 more than the number of Metal Gears you have to fight in the first game.
Yes, and people are always like, "Ah, oh, Raiden's totally a whip," and you're like, he canonically fought like a bunch of anti-Metal Gears and like beat the crap out of them.
Yeah, also in Metal Gear Rising, he cuts one in half in the first 10 minutes of that game. Raiden is literally God.
Perhaps it was my expectations of Rising that made me disappointed I couldn't fight them with my sword, because I thought that's what I was gonna be like, oh, the perfect weapon, but then no, you've got to use the stingers.
You can deflect the bullets, and I think there's probably a chance that you can cut the missiles in half. You can definitely do that with Solidus's stuff later on. You can cut those missiles just straight in half.
Oh, that's cool.
But yeah, you gotta use your stinger, you gotta use your chaff, you can use your grenade launcher that the game gave you for some reason. That's never really useful, but you can use it if you want. Like, all that stuff's available.
So then again, here is, after this big boss fight, you think, wow, here we go, the climax of the game, in which a whole lot of stuff happens, and either of you please feel free to just jump in to kind of add things that I'm missing. So you fight all these Metal Gears, you end up on top of Arsenal Gear eventually.
Olga
is there. Yeah, Olga, she shows up kind of like Gray Fox to save you, right? Like, from, because Raiden eventually gives up when he's fighting all the Metal Gears.
Yeah, he's like, this is way too many robots, and he's correct. It's far too many, and she's gonna help him, and then Solidus is like, nope, he just shoots her.
Solidus shows up, and hey, and again, the contrast between war being bad and violence sometimes being unambiguously cool, I was like, fuck, P90s are so cool. The fact that the way that Solidus, who for some reason has Doc Ock arms, is like throwing people around and using his P90s. I was like, god damn it, this guy, he's neat. But then you get on top of Arsenal. the virus has worked, kind of, that EE put in. Solidus reveals he doesn't care about Arsenal. He's like, Fortune, you can have it. I don't care. All he wanted was the names of the Patriots so he can go kill them, because he doesn't want anyone controlling the world. He wants to live, you know, out of step with the Patriots.
And the only other thing that he really kind of cares about on Arsenal is the fact that it has nukes, and he could detonate one over Manhattan and take it off the grid and just make it his own little place where people could be free.
Yes. Yeah, but then it turns out that an ocelot shows up. Ocelot's like, Solidus, you thought this was about you. It's not. He then spells out that literally the whole game has been exactly the same as Metal Gear Solid 1 on purpose. Everything was set up. Everyone was just actors, including, like, Fortune, he tells her, was not really psychic. They put, like, an electromagnetic thing on her so she could be similar to the supernatural people that Snake fought in Metal Gear Solid 1.
There's no such thing as miracles or the supernatural, only cutting-edge tech.
That's what he tells. That's what the man with an arm of another man attached to him tells us. He shoots Fortune. But Fortune
Hold
is
on.
Okay and actually manages to do some
because
psychic shit. Yes.
Her heart is her on heart. The right side. And when that reveal was dropped, I was like, I'm in the hands of a master here. The lady's heart's on the right
That's
side.
Good. I didn't actually pick up. I mean, I saw the heart line, but I didn't think of it as dumb poetically as that. But I'm sure you are correct.
Dextroparia. Although I don't think they use the term. But that's what it is.
So Ocelot gets ready to kill everyone, but at a crucial moment, Liquid then takes over him. He's been kind of holding, you know, biding his time the whole time, but the arm of Liquid Snake then takes control of Ocelot, decides that he's not going to kill everyone. One thing that kind of stuck out to me in these cutscenes is that Raiden basically becomes completely unimportant to the plot. Like, there are, like, five characters standing there, and Raiden doesn't say or do anything for basically this whole, like, 20-minute scene.
It's all about the snakes. And really, Liquid Snake only shows up in these moments because the expectation is for Liquid Snake to show up in these moments. I mean, the whole thing about his ghost being present, I mean, when you read it through the lens of it being a sequel, he shows up because players want him to show up. Essentially, right, and he'll do that through any means possible, even if it means overwriting another character.
So then, an action moment that we probably wish we were doing, Rey dives off the deck of the ship. Well, Rey shoots a bunch of stuff at them. Fortune manages to deflect it because she is psychic, actually. Take that, science.
In the hands of a master here.
Rey dives off the ship. Snake dives off after Rey. Oh, it's so sick. If only we were playing that character. But we are playing Raiden instead. And then here is the biggest moment of the game where I was like, damn, maybe they shouldn't have taken that thing out for 9/11. Because you see Arsenal driving, and then it just fades to white, and then you're in the middle of the financial district in New York. And it's like, could have used a cutscene of it crashing into the shit, because it is very confusing that you're just suddenly there.
Actually, Jacob, no, this is actually one of the more real to life things. You don't, of course, live in New York. Harper, did you used to live in New York?
I did for about 4 years, almost 5 years.
Unfortunately, sometimes you're just in Manhattan and you look up and you've accidentally entered the financial district and you're like, fuck, how the fuck did I get here and how do I get out of here?
You're just on top of
it's one of the only things that felt like a non-fiction in this game.
Yeah, it happens to all of us once or twice.
We've talked about a lot the 9/11 thing, what has been removed, what hasn't. This part felt, and not just the the cutscene missing was one thing, but there are so many scenes at the end here where you can feel the conspicuous absence of American flags, where the entire shot is framed to include like a character and a flag, and the flag is just not there. And it's like surprising to me that in the discussion of the various things removed by 9/11, this feels like the biggest one of all, that like those shots would be fundamentally different if they had flags there.
Can I leap forward a little bit to say a flag mm-hmm. thing, which is, you know what was going to happen when Raiden killed Solidus, right? Do you know about this at all?
Yeah, well, that he cuts down the flag and it, like, falls.
He was supposed to cut down the flag and it was supposed to drape over his body.
Because, like, that animation is still there. Like, Raiden does a weird thing with his sword that doesn't make any sense. But it does make sense if you know that he's supposed to be cutting down a flag. I just found that very interesting. But here's where we get... Here's the real, like, the real kind of technobabble of this game. And I say that, but I actually love the direction that it goes with this. Blake, give me your read on kind of when Campbell starts really explaining what's going on. How did you feel? Blake is shaking his head.
I don't know, man. Like, I'm sorry. Sometimes Kojima gets going, and I just can't. I can't follow, and it went over my head. I did have a good joke that when you said this was the techno babble, I was gonna say no. Actually, that one was called Ghost Babble. So I'll contribute that. I will now audible to the expert Harper nice. Here to explain this to me.
Oh, are we talking about the selection for societal sanity now? Is that where we're going?
Yes, I think so. And specifically what I want to talk about is what the Patriot, or not the Patriots, but like what Campbell is, like what the AI is, because this was the part that I found kind of most exciting and unexpected.
This is the stuff that kind of gets dropped in later entries in the right. franchise.
I think the idea here about them not creating content but creating context was really fascinating. Is that what you're asking, Jacob? Like that specific moment?
No, it is when Campbell says we're not what you would call human,
yeah.
and
formless.
You get the little skull fakes.
Oh right, and they've like formed organically in America.
Yes, that they are essentially like a consciousness that was formed in the crucible of the White House over hundreds of years, that it is this kind of like this embodiment of the American spirit made manifest and turned into this bizarre robot alien thought control thing. But the idea that it was like it did just kind of happen organically, and this is, I think, and Harper, you can probably confirm this, like, this is kind of the Richard Dawkins thing, where he also writes about, like, this thing almost as being organic, that, like, culture is forming a third entity of some kind.
There's almost an idea here, let me know if I'm getting too lost in the sauce, that America would always be inherently evil, and that there would be, the whole thing with like Campbell and Rose, I find to just be this like reprehensible evil thing. And the fact it's organic is like, well, it would just naturally occur that way. This country would just naturally breed something this like awful.
I don't think it's natural as in it's predetermined. I think it is more that the American project has always been built
yeah.
on cruelty,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
like since the country's inception. And so it's not like it had to be this way. To quote the song from Metal Gear Rising, but instead that, like, this is the only possible outcome when you look at the past 200 years of American history. Like, the only thing that could form would be this kind
yeah.
of eugenics for information
yeah. no,
type program.
I feel like that's what I was thinking.
Okay.
It's sort of positioned as the natural endpoint that arises out of this mixing pot of American political thought, right? And it's important to note, you know, it's not, you know, they're not saying we were created out of the worst impulses of these specific politicians from this party or whatever. The idea here is this is a collective force that represents all of American political power. Regardless of party, regardless of time and place, it all builds to this entity which eventually seeks to police language, to police thought. Language, again, another thing that's very important in Phantom Pain. Kojima really concerned with what it means to limit the ability to express a thought, and that's sort of something here as well. The idea that eventually America itself becomes such a fundamental force of nature that it has a continuity that extends beyond its citizenry or its politicians. It just becomes, you know, a natural disaster almost, the same way that a hurricane exists. It's very possible.
Yeah, and I think something that we touched on last time is, like, my I dislike ideas like the Illuminati in part because the idea of essentially like a secret race of lizard people or whatever who are controlling the country and doing all of this stuff, which often spins into anti-Semitism when you're talking about these sort of conspiracy theories, is like it is too easy. It's too kind of dumb to just think that like the whole thing is the fault of, in this case, 12 patriots who are deciding everything and have replaced the president. And what I found so much more compelling about this idea is that it is like, it is just this kind of unstoppable institutional force that is the collective result of all of the decisions that have been made over hundreds of years, you know. And this is like when I used to be in actual critical race theory classes in college, you know, not like learning about Martin Luther King critical race theory, we would talk about how the force of white supremacy in the U.S. is essentially like anything that people might want to attribute to the Illuminati. Like, those kind of things have actually happened, and they have been largely as a result of white supremacy. And the idea that, like, for instance, for modern capitalism to exist, there needs to be essentially an underclass who works for almost no pay, either like literal slavery or like, you know, immigration and undocumented migrants being able to be paid essentially slave wages. And the way that like the country adapts so that these systems survive, that when slavery ends or when Jim Crow ends, there is a new underclass that is created so that this kind of thing can keep happening. And it is not that there is 12 guys in a room saying, like, how do we make sure there's still an underclass to continue the American capitalist project? It is that kind of the entire country is pointed towards this goal because its history has made it into a mechanism for white supremacy and a mechanism for, like, you know, gender control and, you know, all of the other systems of oppression that kind of spawn out of the same idea of oppression. And so, like, it's just, I was just so glad and excited that the game, again, maybe giving too much credit to Kojima for thinking through all of these things, but that it does not take the simplistic approach of just being like, it's a bunch of, you know, it's a handful of bad people who are making the bad decisions for all of us.
Yeah, I think it's important to note too, because we're talking fundamentally about what the Patriots are and not necessarily right now what they want. Mm-hmm. The thing they want, obviously, is control in the most broad sense. But to say more specifically the thing that they are afraid of, it's freely shared information, right? The argument here is that the raw political force that is America is threatened in the early moments of the wider digital age by the ability for its citizenry to freely converse, to freely have access to information, and to freely, you know, sort of learn about things removed from the specific mechanisms of you know, media conglomerates and things like that. To a certain extent, that's like a very quixotic way of looking at the internet, right? It's a very early internet idea of like, this thing is so big that it enables all this free thought, which can fundamentally threaten the upper class. And I mean, there's ways in which we've seen that's true. We've seen the importance of social media in certain movements and things like that. So there's truth to it. But there's also a way in which it's a very early conception of the internet, of this idea of people having access to information in a way that empowers them, with the caveat that, and this is a thing where I think this is one of the things that people consider more prescient out of anything that's said here. Another argument that ultimately arises when Rose and Campbell are talking to you about their, you know, the Patriots' anxieties is that, yes, initially there will be all this sort of access to information which empowers people, but eventually it starts to turn into something more balkanized, right? So it's this burst of information that empowers the citizenry, and then over time those pools get corrupted until there's a certain fragmenting that happens as well, which to a certain extent represents a sort of breaking of like the American id or ego or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's I think what you're referring to, or one of the lines that hit for me the most, is Rose says, or you know, AI Rose says, everyone withdraws into their own small gated community, afraid of a larger forum. They stay inside their little ponds, leaking whatever truth suits them into the growing cesspool of society at large. And the Colonel says, the different cardinal truths neither clash nor mesh. No one is invalidated, but no one is right. Which, yeah, kind of is like, if you want to read that as describing subreddits, it sure does feel like it describes subreddits. But I also think that's a kind of a limited way of looking at like the true commentary that it's making.
But it is interesting in the sense that it really is, you're provided with the ability to pursue your own expression and creativity. And it's a very, I mean, I guess it's prescient, but it's also a very unflattering idea that even with that, what eventually happens is that you get radicalized.
Yeah.
In one way or another.
I want to read one more thing about this, and then I want to move on to Raiden choosing his own destiny, because we can't leave that behind. But there's a blog on called Metal Gear Solid 2 is Not About the Internet by Matthew Weiss that was written in 2020, kind of in reaction to like discussions about like Trump and the internet and all that, where he says, it's amazing to me that even today, in a world that looks an awful lot like the dystopian one MGS2 was projecting, critics who laud the game seem mired in its finer points about tech and nerd culture rather than its larger points about mythology, oligarchy, and propaganda. Focusing on how it portrays the dangers of social media seem especially misguided, since those dangers in the context of MGS2's totalitarian narrative are the excuse the government gives as to why citizens should not be allowed to govern themselves. It's not a critique made by the game, it's a critique made by the fascist government in the game to justify their fascism. And so there is this way in which us talking about how Metal Gear Solid 2 is about the internet, and us, you know, broadly, not just in this conversation, like, there is so much going on in this game's ending that it is really hard to communicate kind of the different fine points that it is putting on, like, what it views as dangers and what it views as, you know, like, what is going to happen with history. Anyway, let's talk about, as we draw to a close here, what does Raiden do with all this? Because there is kind of this large narrative of what the country is doing, and then there is this very focused individual narrative on, like, what do you do with this? And Harper, when you were writing about it, I think this was where you, I'll let you say if you say this or not, but, like, your essay really seemed to find the most, like, emotional resonance in the idea of, like, what Raiden does in this world that it's kind of spiraling out of control.
He just kind of cuts his way out of it, right? Like, it's important. I mean, images, right? Solidus throws the sword and it breaks the handcuffs on Raiden, right? And he's forced into this fight, but at the same time, it's a necessary one, both for survival, but also kind of removing himself from the weird espionage project that he's been a part of. I mean, the end of the game in theory is just, hey, go talk to your girlfriend, go talk to people, but in order to get there, he has to go through the ringer a little bit.
It is kind of, it's interesting that the game ends with this kind of message of, like, you have to choose your own path. It almost feels too simple given, like, everything that it has confronted us with. It's like, how could we possibly choose our own path when the real S3, which I don't know if we said, is the system for societal sanity that is essentially like a thought-controlled device for the entire country or world to define kind of what their truth is. But you know, as Snake says, you just have to pick something to believe in and then do it. And, like, what you believe in has to be up to you.
Yeah, Raiden's very much like, what should I believe in? Snake's like, man, do whatever, man. It's not my problem. Just stop being a product of everyone else around you and start to self-direct just a little bit, please. But, I mean, and it's small steps, first steps, but...
Blake, what do you think of like the style of these last couple cutscenes?
A little bland. I like when Raiden throws the name tag. I kind of wish I would have put my own name so it would have made it hit a little harder. I put Reagan's, my dog's name, and I was like, oh.
I put Raiden because I thought that, what you're supposed to do with like Link.
I don't know. Like, I think
you didn't like the real life footage of New York.
I was like, hey, that's where I live. There's my apartment. That's not true. I don't live in that area. That would be a crazy place to live. No, I think there is in MGS1 and MGS2 especially, there's this like MGS2 is presenting such a bleak idea of the world, especially the world Kojima at that point seemed to think we were about to enter. As the internet proliferated further. And I think this, like, you know, there's that quote from Dazed and Confused where McConaughey's character is like, you just gotta keep living, man. LIVIN. And that's kind of what the ending of this game is, in a way. And I'm like, it's too simple. It's too neat. It's too wiping my hands clean of everything else I just said to be like, Raiden, you just gotta have a passion, man. Go play. Take up like violin, man. Like, be stoked on it. You know, like, you ever tried photography? You might like it. Go to a wine and painting class. It's like, well, no, we can't really just walk away from that. Like, the ending, and there's some weird shit here. Like, Rose shows up and it's like, is she real or not? Is Raiden completely delusional by this point?
Vamp is in the background and like, he looks closely for 2 seconds.
There's shit going on there, but I think the message that this game ends on doesn't work for me when you present me your bleak idea for the future. I can't walk away from that thought and just be like, well, I just gotta like really commit myself to how into reading books I am. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's too simple. It's an attempt at a clean break from what you're doing that I just don't get down with.
I suppose. I mean, ultimately the thing that's being said is that in the face of forces that are so incomprehensibly bigger and more powerful than you, one of the only things that you can do in reaction to that is to live authentically, right? And that, it's certainly a little trite, but it rings true, I think, to a certain extent. I wish that it wasn't maybe, if there's one thing I actually think is a bit of a detriment to the end of the game is like the way in which Snake really becomes, a mouthpiece for the author, way more explicitly than maybe he ever has. I mean, we have this in the first Metal Gear Solid where there's a cutscene near the end and it's like, it's Naomi just talking about like, you're not tied to your genes, man. There's like, I almost find that a really interesting, like, expression of a lack of trust in the player, because if you've gotten this far, hopefully you already get it. You don't need Snake to spell it out to you again, but I don't know, maybe some folks do. Clearly some folks do.
Yeah, I mean, I do like, a line that I did love was, Snake says, you know, it's obvious, but Snake says we need to let our children read about our sad and messy history by its light, you know, which is another kind of thing of like, hey, man, you can't live in this country without interacting with its bad history. And I want to say, like, aesthetically, I loved this part, both because the live footage of New York mirrors the nature footage of Alaska in this really interesting way, where like at the end of MGS1 you're seeing like polar bears and seals and wolves, and here you're seeing like people walk around New York, and it is kind of like our constructed world can be beautiful too if we allow it to be. There are cathedrals everywhere if you have eyes to see. The fact that it is playing like jazz piano really just felt very targeted at me, that like I end so many of my own videos with like jazz piano, and I think it is such this, you know, it is a quintessentially American style of music. I think the kind of like all of the feeling that is in jazz and the history that you can see there really, really works. And then in the cutscene parts, the fact that Snake and Raiden are just standing there being cartoon characters while everywhere else around them are like normal looking people just walking to their jobs really makes it feel dreamlike in this way that again feels like it's acknowledging kind of how artificial a video game is when compared to the real world. And so it's just like, you know, from an artistic perspective, it was really hitting on all points for me.
I also think Can't Say Goodbye to Yesterday is just kind of a sweet little song. Maybe a little on the nose, a little bit. There's a certain degree in which like this game is very much like New York, baby. Which is true, I love New York, but
I think it earns it.
Yeah, it's fine.
There are a million more things that we could say about this game, but we do need to wrap up here. Harper, thank you so much for coming on, lending us your years of experience thinking and writing about this game.
You're always so kind about my work, and I must say,
it was a big influence on me.
I think my work is very messy. I think my book is very messy.
This game.
but I don't know. Metal Gear is messy, so maybe that's okay.
We'll put a link to your writing here. Check out Double Fine, check out Psych Odyssey. I'm sure the studio will also be doing fun things in the future that we will be able to talk about. But until then, this has been Something Rotten, talking about Metal Gear Solid 2. My name is Jacob Geller, for Blake Hester. Turn the game console off right now!
And by the way, the Patriots had died 100 years before the events of this game, and that's the final reveal at the
end. Yeah, they're all dead.
So just keep that in mind, listeners. Bye!
Kind of snuck that in there the way the credits did.